We're going to bring you some more music. But first, we're going to have some Lost in the Stacks. We've got three wonderful librarians here in the studio with us that are all looking at me strangely as I talk and weave and live through my life. And I'm now attempting to not laugh as I get ready for Lost in the Stacks. Hope you've enjoyed the music. And now for something completely different.
Marshall, Will, and Holly on a routine expedition met the greatest earthquake ever known. High on the rapids, it struck their tiny raft and plunged them down 1,000 feet below to the land.
Are listening to WREK Atlanta, and this is Lost in the Stacks, the one and only research library rock and roll radio show. I am Amit. My absent co-host is Charlie. He's given a TED Talk, and we both work at the Georgia Tech Library. Perry is on the board.
We really should have gotten someone named Ted to do this.
Perry, when are you giving your TED Talk?
As soon as I do something particularly remarkable.
2023. That's when I...
Okay.
We've got Fred, Lizzie, Allie, Chris in the studio. And for the next hour, we've got music and library talk for you. Whichever you're here for, we hope you dig it.
Dig it like digging a fossil.
Dig it!
Today's show is called The Land of the Lost in the Stacks because it's a dinosaur-themed show, and my inner six-year-old is pretty stoked about it.
We're going to be talking with Mike Taylor and Matt Wadle, scientists who get to do research on dinosaur fossils for a living. They get paid to do that, to dig it.
That's a nice gig to dig.
And when they publish that research, they always make sure that research is openly accessible.
Mike and Matt also author the popular blog Sauropod Vertebra Picture of the Week, that's svpow.com, which is about dinosaurs and open access, and I'll ask them about both.
I'm hoping for some delightfully cheesy jokes about how scholarly communication is evolving, or dinosaur publishers are going extinct.
Right,
people can't see my air quotes.
With the air quotes. They'll be cheesy. I don't know how delightful they'll be. Yeah, no doubt about it. Our music today is all about dinosaurs, which is awesome. So let's start with an instrumental from 1960 called Brontosaurus Stomp by the Piltdown Men right here on Lost in the Stacks. We'll be right back.
This is Lost in the Stacks, but today we might call it Land of the Lost in the Stacks because we have a dinosaur-themed show today. And we're joined via Skype by two paleontological experts, Dr. Mike Taylor, Research Associate at the Department of Earth Sciences at the University of Bristol in England, and Dr. Matt Waitel, Assistant Professor of Anatomy at the Western University of Health Sciences in California. Together, they are authors of the blog Sauropod Vertebra Picture of the Week, or SVPOW for short. And librarians probably know this blog best as a platform for promoting open access in scholarly communication in addition to the dinosaur stuff. Matt and Mike, welcome to our program.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
I'll start with an easy one for you guys probably, but difficult for me and our listeners maybe. What is a sauropod, and what in the world does it have to do with open access?
Sauropods are long-necked dinosaurs, the biggest, most spectacular, God's noblest creatures, I like to call them. And we have been researching and publishing on sauropods for about 15 years for me and a little over a decade, or about a decade for Mike. And as we were writing scientific papers, we realized that open access was clearly to us, the best method for getting our information out to the world.
Okay. So what made you decide that that this blog had was going to be a promotional vehicle for open access? And I guess let me frame that kind of in context. Like maybe where there was a moment when you realize that, you know, not only am I going to talk about my field of study, sauropods, but I'm going to use this platform to talk about open access. What made it that important?
No, there was no moment, and there was never really a decision either. We just, in between all the things we were writing about sauropods, we found ourselves writing more and more, as we thought of them, off-topic posts about open access and other problems with the publishing ecosystem as it is now. And the more that happened, the more we realized that that was a legitimate topic for the blog.
So it literally started out as just being pictures of these fossil vertebrae.
Yeah.
Initially,
it was a sort of riff on astronomy picture of the day, which NASA puts out. And we thought we can do a sauropod vertebrae every week. And then we were going to just write very brief descriptions of each picture. And then we found ourselves writing more about them. And then after a while, the sauropod vertebrae pictures were just tagged on the end of things that we'd written.
And Matt, the cause of open access is kind of dear to you as well. It seems interesting that both of you started this blog with, you know, one purpose in mind, and then you both kind of found this other cause to promote on your blog.
Yeah, open access is something that I think has sort of grown over us over the past few years. I was finishing up my dissertation at Berkeley when the Public Library of Science, or PLOS, was started, and so I knew some of the people who were involved in starting it, and I thought it sounded excellent, but I hadn't really had time to think deeply about what it would mean, about what the move, not just the foundation of PLOS, but the move towards open access would mean for scholarly publishing. And then as time went on, we went, I think, from thinking that open access was obviously a good thing to thinking that it was a crucial thing, to thinking that publishing outside of open access was actually wrong because you were denying people the results of your work.
So, Matt, have you followed that in your publications? You're actually just exclusively publishing open access now.
I am now, yeah. Actually, I think probably 2011 was the last time that either of us published a paper outside of open access journals.
In your own personal experience of publishing open access, Mike, do you feel like you get support from your institute? Are they encouraging of you to publish open access?
I don't really have any sense of Bristol having a strong feeling for or against, to be honest. I've just started the process of trying to get an institutional open access mandate on the table. I've got no idea whether they're going to pick up on that.
But in your department, do you face any feedback in like reviews for tenure and things like that? Is there like an implied push to publish in certain venues?
Now, this is the wonder of being an associate researcher as I am. So in my day job, I earn my money by programming computers. So no one can really tell me what to do in my research because I'm doing it unpaid in my spare time.
Matt, you're in a different situation. You are actually your assistant professor currently.
Yes, that's correct.
And so you do go you do go through the tenure process.
Yeah, actually, I'm up for tenure as we speak. My case is being decided on, and I'll probably find out later this spring. So I haven't felt any pressure to publish in open access venues other than what I've put on myself. Obviously, the librarians here are very aware of open access and very in support of it. And there are some faculty that are knowledgeable about open access and push for it, and others who aren't. So that's one of the things that I'm trying to do here, is just increase awareness about open access on campus.
So faculty education is kind of a key to promoting open access.
Absolutely. And it's been a huge part, I think, of the evolution of my views and Mike's views on open access, is that at first, you don't really realize the depth with which researchers and the public are getting screwed by barrier-based commercial publishers. And just getting people to acknowledge the reality of the situation. And then once you've got that, then it's pretty natural for them to seek a more fair solution.
Right. What you're saying is that faculty may not tend to realize that they're signing over their copyrights when they're publishing in the traditional venues.
Absolutely.
Mike, you're at a British Institute. Do you find that attitudes are different there, or is there more awareness of open access?
I think there is, because our government's been gradually pushing. It's kind of a bit of push and a bit of pull, actually. It's very much one step forward and half a step backwards. But it's at least got the issue on the agenda. So most of the funding for research in Britain is from one of the councils that make up Research Councils UK, and they now have a pretty good open access policy.
Well, to take it to the other end, as a consumer of research, have either of you ever hit a barrier and thought, you know, well, open access could solve this, or why am I hitting this barrier now? Has a lack of open access ever hindered your research?
Constantly, all the time. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for me too. Unfortunately, here at Western, we have our librarians are fantastic at interlibrary loan requests and typically get them to us very quickly, but it's still time out of my day, time out of their day, a day or two of delay on research that, you know, sometimes you're really rolling along and you hit a wall, and that train of thought, that idea that you're developing, just has to be put on hold for 2 days. There's an opportunity cost there in not being able to complete the work that's right in front of you, because you have to stop and wait for a silly workaround to, frankly, silly barriers.
Well, we're going to need to stop, take a quick break now. We will be right back with Mike Taylor and Matt Wadle after a brief break for some music.
File this set under QH45.5.G68.
Dinosaurs lived a long time ago. They were terrible lizards, don't you know? Some ate plants and some ate meat. Some ate fish and some ate beets. One was called a Diplodocus. One was bigger than your school bus. One was called a Triceratops. Three horns to stop anything it hops. Now, can't you just see yourself walking along, leading your pet Trachodon, or feeding your Brontosaurus Rex, or scratching your Diplodocus neck, or riding on a Stegosaurus back, or swimming in a Brachiosaurus track? Oh, what a time and oh, what fun playing tag with your Iguanodon. And if we had dinosaurs now, could they get along with a horse and a cow? Well, I wish they hadn't have become extinct. Dinosaurs would be nice pets and friends to have around to run outside and play with every day, don't you think? We'll be right back.
That was Dinosaur by King Crimson, and before that, the Dinosaur Song by Johnny Cash. Songs about the way life used to be, for reptiles and for publishers.
Welcome back to Lost in the Stacks, and we're back with our guests Mike Taylor and Matt Waddle, paleontology experts who also happen to be authors of the blog Sauropod Vertebra Picture of the Week, SVPOW, which is about both dinosaurs and open access publishing. Now, I've noticed in your blog that you recently have started making your own academic publications based, you've done it a couple of times, I think, based on blog posts. Like something will start out as a blog post. You post something about a sauropod vertebra or something along those lines, and it turns into an actual academic paper. Mike, we'll put this question to you. Do you think this is indicative of how publishing is changing?
It's like so many of the things we've done. It kind of came about by accident, and it just feels like a very natural way to do things now. So Matt wrote what turned out to be a series of 6 or 7 long posts in response to a paper that was published in our field that we took issue with. And having written all that, it just seemed like the most natural thing in the world to say, let's glue the blog post together and call them a paper. And get some academic credit for them, because, of course, we're still at a time where Matt's tenure case isn't helped by anything that he blogs, but is helped by things that go in recognized journals.
Right. And I guess, Matt, this kind of harkens back to what we were talking about in the first segment. The blog posts, I suppose, weren't quite enough. Like, you couldn't get credit for them, as Mike put it. So those had to be kind of synthesized into an academic journal. Do you see a time maybe when your SVPOW blog is your academic output? Or is that just way too far in the future?
I think that we're headed towards a future that has something like that, because so many scientists are blogging now, and they're not just blogging about science that they do elsewhere. They're doing science on the blog. And that was the light bulb thing with the series of blog posts that we turned into a paper, is we had intended that it would always be a paper, and we were sort of test driving it on the blog. And what we realized is this allows you to get instant feedback and find the weak arguments, find the places where you say something that wasn't supported. So now, even for papers that I had no intention of putting on the blog first, I'm thinking, should I test drive these ideas on the blog to get feedback? Because we are fortunate to have a very knowledgeable and active group of commenters. And a lot of our colleagues read the blog and comment freely. So it's nice to, you know, if you send a paper off, you might have to wait 3 or 4 months to get feedback. If you blog it, you'll get feedback in 3 or 4 hours.
So do you think peer review then, this is a kind of peer review? Your peers in the field see your blog post and, you know, comment on it, and that informs your academic paper. Do you think along with open access we're going to see more open peer review, Matt?
Yeah, absolutely.
Thanks. I think already we're starting to see a continuum now of degrees of formality in peer review. So at one extreme, you've got the very traditional journals. You'll know that PLOS One and some other mega journals now review on whether something is sound science, but explicitly don't try to evaluate how significant or exciting it is. And then at the far end, you've got comments on blogs. But in between was another really useful experience we had recently, is we posted a preprint. So it was a completed manuscript ready, we hoped, for submission to a journal. But instead of sending it to a journal, we put it on the PeerJ preprint server,
right,
and solicited peer reviews from the community rather than waiting for an editor to send it out to individuals they chose. And within 24 hours, we had 3 really helpful detailed reviews that are going to dramatically improve that manuscript. So when we do submit it to a journal, it's going to be significantly stronger for that.
Which never would have happened under the more traditional system. That input, you never would have received that in the beginning, right?
No. And if we got it at all, it would have taken 6 months instead of 24 hours.
Yeah, and there's 2 aspects to we wouldn't have gotten that feedback. One is we wouldn't have gotten it that fast, and 2 is some of the feedback we wouldn't have gotten at all, because some of the people who made useful comments would not have been picked by an editor to send the paper to, because they're maybe 1 or 2 removes from our little niche but they still had fantastically accurate and useful things to say about the paper. So I think that the push towards this is going to be driven a lot by researchers who don't see much value in waiting months for feedback when they can get it within a day or two.
Right. So the idea isn't that we want to do away with peer review. We actually want to get more of it and get it in faster so that it's actually improving the paper rather than just being a barrier that you have to jump through.
So with I think it's probably fair to say that there's a lot of commercial publishers on there, maybe society publishers as well, that still kind of cling to the old pre-electronic, pre-internet model. Corny joke alert. Is it fair to call them dinosaurs? Is this change inevitable? Mike?
I'm going to make the obvious point, of course, that calling them dinosaurs would be a huge compliment. So for 150 million years, dinosaurs were the dominant form of life on the planet. Here we are 65 years after the end of the Cretaceous, and still there are more living dinosaur species than there are mammal species. I'm talking about the birds, of course.
Right.
So, in fact, they were a spectacularly successful group that adapted and coped with changing circumstances amazingly well. So, actually, the old barrier-based commercial publishers could hardly be more different.
So, are publishers going to have to adopt the new models like PeerJ to survive? Or are they going to have to all be like PLOS and PeerJ and things like that, Mike?
Well, I think that those are the kinds of publishers that people are going to use. And you know, for our own papers now, we just look at what's on offer and say everything in Elsevier Journal can do, PeerJ will do better and faster and make it open and cost much less. So in terms of competition, it's just a whitewash. So the question becomes whether those legacy publishers can make a conversion to running in a way that lets them compete with the newer publishers. And my guess will be no, but who knows? They might surprise us.
Well, with that, we're going to have to take another music break, but we're going to be back on the left side of the hour with more from our guests here on Lost in the Stacks.
You're listening to WREK Atlanta, and this is Lost in the Stacks, the one and only research library rock and roll radio show. Today's show is called The Land of Lost in the Stacks. What most don't know is that Georgia Tech's biology department has made a real-life Jurassic Park on the seventh floor of the library. I mean, okay, really, there's only one attraction. He's in a pterodactyl in a cage. We named him Buttons. Buttons the pterodactyl. File this set under QE841.C254.
Thank you. And baby, there you go. Take a black cat and a sip you on your shoulder. And in the morning, you'll know all you
And the World Isn't Flat Anymore by The Vindictives. Before that, Ride a White Swan by T-Rex. And Walking in Your Footsteps by The Police. Songs about choosing your evolutionary path.
Welcome back to Lost in the Stacks. Our guests today are open access advocate and paleontology experts Mike Taylor and Matt Wadle. We have talked a bit about open access, but guys, we can't let you get away without having you teach us and our listeners a little bit about dinosaurs. So your SV Pal blog, obviously a lot about open access, very informative to librarians, but it does also have sauropod vertebrae, and sauropods, as you mentioned before, those long necks like in that first scene in Jurassic Park, right? Like Brachiosaurus and things like that.
Yep, those are our folks.
So what can you tell about a sauropod just from a single backbone?
You do comparative anatomy. So if you found a bone from a cow or a bison, something like that, even if it was a new species, you would be able to reconstruct a lot of it just by doing comparisons with other animals that you knew better. Sauropod vertebrae are particularly interesting to us because they're full of these chambers and pockets that were formed by air sacs, just like the ones the birds have. So if you have a look at your chicken or turkey bones, the next time you have those around, you'll see holes going into the bones, bringing air inside the bones, and these gigantic animals, which were also dinosaurs, shared that same system.
So mammals don't have that?
No, we have air-filled bones in our heads, our sinuses, which are mostly useful for giving us headaches, apparently, but none in the rest of our bodies.
So a huge sauropod, like a Brachiosaurus, their bone structure has more common with a bird than, say, us or a cow or something.
Yeah, vastly more.
Wow. When I look at a picture of a Brontosaurus or Brachiosaurus, it's amazing that this skeletal structure could support an organism. Would you call this a feat of structural engineering, or is there more to it than meets the eye?
Yeah, both of those things. I mean, you're absolutely right. It's structural engineering, and there are paleontologists whose whole research program is to do with looking at extinct animals as machines and figuring out how strong the muscles could have been and what moments they could have exerted and the implications that has for how fast they could move and all those kinds of things. So, yeah, they're amazingly elegant constructions, and that's particularly true of sauropods. To hark back to Matt's praise of sauropods at the top of the program, they really are the most beautiful animals once you start looking at how they're put together.
Now, Mike, I think you're aware of this. Matt, you may also be, but we have a sauropod exhibit here in Atlanta in our Fernbank Natural History Museum. There is a skeleton of fossil skeleton, I guess, of Argentinosaurus, and it is huge, it's mind-blowingly huge. Is that a cast?
So it is a cast. Yeah. Argentinosaurus is probably the largest dinosaur, the largest land animal for which we have fossil remains right now. And what we have is not very much. We have about half a dozen vertebrae from the backbone and a couple of limb bones. And the rest of the skeleton is an educated guess, you might say, based on the skeletons of other large sauropods. So it probably didn't look exactly like that, but it's probably a reasonable facsimile of what the largest individuals of Argentinosaurus would have been like.
Wait, this whole assembly that's in Fernbank Museum is an educated guess?
Not entirely. Some of the vertebrae and one or two of the limb bones are cast, but the rest is sculpted.
So it's a sculpture more than a fossil display.
Right. It's based on a true story.
Mike, this dinosaur is depicted as being attacked by a Gigantosaurus. Did I pronounce that correctly?
Yeah, that'll do.
Oh, okay, that's close enough. And in comparison to this possibly imagined, vastness of Argentinosaurus, this Gigantosaurus looks pretty small, but in the display they have it looking like it could maybe take this thing down, or it looks like it's intending to. Could that possibly happen?
I don't see one Giganotosaurus taking down an Argentinosaurus, but you probably know there's some cases where groups of lions have been desperate enough to take down elephants, and you can just about imagine a situation like that, maybe with pack hunting. But then we don't really know whether they were even intelligent enough for pack hunting. It's hard to judge these sort of aspects of how they lived.
Is the Giganotosaurus at least how much of an educated guess is that fossil assemblage here at Fernbank?
Oh, that's much better. It's it's pretty much complete, is my understanding. Is that Matt?
I think that Giganotosaurus itself is probably known about 50% or so, but it has very close relatives like Acrocanthosaurus, for which we have complete skeletons. So there's much less guesswork in that skeleton, and you can take it pretty much as what that animal looked like.
Okay, so slightly more reliable than the Argentinosaurus display.
Yeah. Also, in saying it looks pretty tiny next to the Argentinosaurus, you're selling it a little bit short.
Right. I think everything would probably look pretty tiny next to the Argentinosaurus.
We're talking about an elephant-sized carnivore. Do you think the biggest carnivores we have alive today top out around 500 kilograms? Then that would have been somewhere between 10 and 20 times as heavy.
Wow. Mike Taylor is at the University of Bristol in the UK, and Matt Waddell is with the Western University of Health Sciences in California, and they are the co-authors of the popular dinosaur and open access blog Sauropod Vertebra Picture of the Week, SVPOW. I like saying it that way. Mike and Matt, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having us on. It was a pleasure.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun.
And we'll be right back with more Lost in the Stacks after another music break.
File this set under QE862.S3.
Come on down to the Big Dig. Come on down to the Big Dig. Come on to the Big Dig. Singing the Smithsonian Institute blues. Singing the Smithsonian Institute blues. The way it's going, the Brea Top hits. I know you just can't lose. The new dinosaur is walking in the old one's shoes. Come on down to the Big Dig. Can't get around the Big Dig. This may be premature, but if I'm wrong, you can just say it's the first time I was happy to be confused. Singing the Smithsonian Institute blues. Smithsonian Institute Blues.
1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4.
I thought he'd never leave.
Well, I'm a little dinosaur. I'm a little dinosaur. I'm a little dinosaur, but I'm planning. the children upon their lawn will wake up and wonder where I've gone. And the flies that buzz around where I now be, they're all gonna have to get along without me. They'll say,
where's the little dinosaur?
I didn't think
where's
he'd really go.
I'm a Little Dinosaur by Jonathan Richman. Before that, Smithsonian Institute Blues by Captain Beefheart. Yet more songs about dinosaurs that we wanted to fit into today's show.
Amit.
Fred.
What is going on at the library next week?
I'm glad you asked. Next week, librarians will teach drop-in classes on MATLAB, Photoshop, poster creation, InDesign, and a full-on frontal library orientation. We are the Georgia Tech Library, and we are at your service.
Lost in the Stacks is a collaboration between WREK Atlanta and the Georgia Tech Library, written and produced by Amit Doshi and Charlie Bennett.
Fred Rasko is our music supervisor, and our associate producers are Wendy Hagenmeyer and Lizzie Rolando.
Our engineer today was Perry Schumann, and our show team is Anthony Nguyen, Colin Caldwell, and Ali Lau.
Legal counsel and food for the library dinosaur buttons were provided by the Burris Intellectual Property Law Group here in Atlanta, Georgia.
Special thanks to Mike and Matt for being on the show today, to Fred for producing this week, and thanks, as always, to each and every one of you for listening.
You can hear the show again at WREK.org/lostinthestacks, and you can find our podcast on iTunes or at lostinthestacks.libsyn.com. That's LIBSYN.
Next week on Lost in the Stacks, we start Feats of Engineering. No, we are not starting Feats. We are starting a series, Feats of Engineering, with high-density storage units and the Plan-O-Matic.
For our last song today, we honor a musical legend who, before he passed away this week, wrote many great songs about changing and evolving in a positive direction. This is the late, great Pete Seeger with Turn, Turn, Turn here on Lost in the Stacks.
To everything, turn, 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 there is a season. Turn, 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 and a time to every purpose under heaven. A time to be born, a time to die, a time to plant, a time to reap, a time to kill, a time to heal, a time to laugh, a time to weep. To everything, turn, 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 there is a season. Turn, 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 and a time for every purpose under heaven. A time to build up, a time to break down, a time to dance, a time to mourn, a time to cast away stones, a time to gather stones together. To everything, turn, 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 there is a season. Turn, 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 and a time to every purpose under heaven. A
A time of love, a time of hate, a time of war, a time of peace. A time you may embrace, a time to refrain from embracing. To everything turn, turn, turn. There is a season, turn, turn, turn. And a time for every purpose under heaven. A time to gain, a time to lose, a time to rend, a time to sow. A time of love, a time of hate, a time of peace. I swear it's not too late. To everything turn, turn, turn. There is a season, turn, turn, turn. And a time to every purpose under heaven. To everything, turn, turn, turn. There is a season, turn, turn, turn. And a time for every purpose under heaven.
And now a mailbag.
Dear Lost in the Stacks, we hope you enjoy the We Need Libraries video by One Man and His Beard, available on YouTube now. Be sure to tell people that your picture made the cut. At We Need Libraries, the United Kingdom. And for folks who are interested, Charlie, I believe, did post the video on the Lost in the Stacks Facebook page.
And so by that, our picture made the cut. So us here in Lost in the Stacks, we're in that video?
Yeah, well, I believe so.
I'm not in the picture. I had to take the picture.
Oh, do you have a library card, though?
I did not have one with me that day, and I am ashamed of myself.
Well, we could Photoshop you in. I'm not sure what kind of, like, maybe there's a Creative Commons license or something on this video. We could modify it,
attribution, share alike.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
We could do that.
Yeah, definitely.
This we're building on prior work.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah, I think Charlie would approve. I don't know.
Oh, yeah.
We'll see. Someone had to
Charlie's
take
not here, so say, we're...
we're running it now.
Yeah. You know, someone had to take the fall for, you know, having a picture for that.
So we appreciate libraries. We got our library cards. We got our library cards, and we're going to use them.
Yes, definitely. And thanks for reminding us about the awesome video.
All right. So with that, I guess we're out. Have a great weekend, everybody.
You are listening to Lost in the Stacks here on WREK Atlanta, and that was yet another hour of library talk and some good music brought to you by our pals over at the library. Charlie should be back next week. I'm looking for approval nods. Charlie's back next week. Charlie is back next week. And we will see you here, same time, same place, and hopefully you'll have a great weekend.